Hello, friends, and welcome to Conversations with Consequences. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association, where we aim to change the culture one conversation at a time. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern, or catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on Sirius XM Channel 130. Of course, our radio show is always a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org/podcasts or directly to wherever you listen to your podcasts. Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. For this segment, I'm on with the entire Catholic Association team, Ashley McGuire, Maureen Ferguson, and Lee Sneed. We're all very excited to talk to our next guest. His name is Tim Carney. He's a father of six. He's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a columnist at the Washington Examiner, where you may have read his work. You're also going to want to read his new book that was just published. It's called Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. He went around the country traveling many states. He's going to give us the details, asking families and experts the same two questions. Why is parenting so hard now? And why are the results so bad? So welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, give us an overview of your book. I mentioned that you traveled around and made interviews.
So the few phenomena that really jump out at me, one is just children are more anxious. There's pediatrician groups, all sorts of folks have said there's actually an epidemic of childhood anxiety. Parents are definitely stressed, and the birth rate is falling to record lows. And, you know, we've had fewer babies almost every year in America for 15 years going on now. And that's through good economic times and bad economic times. And it's up and down the income scale. So to me, that points to a problem in our culture, and that we have a culture that doesn't adequately support families. Now, I'm a guy who thinks that the nuclear family is the most important institution we have, right? I think my job as a dad is up there. I'm a dad and a husband. That's my main jobs. But I also know that a nuclear family isn't sufficient to raising kids, that the family needs support, and that comes from community institutions. That comes from the broader society. To some extent, it comes from government saying family comes first and privileging family over everything else. And we no longer have that. And so that's why young people aren't, so it goes across all aspects of culture. Parenting culture is off the rails. Like, local little leagues get replaced by these intensive, expensive travel leagues. You got dating and mating culture is all messed up, and 20-year-olds aren't getting married. The apps are getting to their brains. They have bad ideas about sort of against commitment. And ultimately, our cultural values are not consistent with family. The idea of commitment, the idea of laying down your life for other people, the idea that we're supposed to sort of inherit or get a cultural inheritance that we pass down to the next generation, a lot of those things seem old-fashioned. And so to have a healthy, happy family, you need to be kind of countercultural. You need to not do all the super helicopter parenting. You need to embed yourself in a tightly knit community. And that's just less and less common in the U.S.
Tim, this is Ashley. I loved your story talking about embedding yourself in a tightly knit community of the Friday night sports thing where you just found kids playing and then everybody else, I think as you put it, just doing what they want. And I laughed because we found a similar thing in our little neighborhood where we moved to, where when I first went to our Friday night lights, which is also on the blacktop turf at our church, I couldn't believe how kids were just like rolling around on the side. The parents had koozies and it was so much fun. And it was almost like you could hear the pressure valve in the area release. And when we first moved to the neighborhood, I was so used to living in DC that I would sort of send my kids on recon missions to find, when they saw kids walking alone, I was like, oh, how old they are. Not because I was scared for my kids' safety, but I was worried about parents getting the cop, you know, calling the cops on me. Leading to my question, I know people who actually had CPS called on them for letting their children, who were at least 7, 8, 9, play alone unsupervised in their front yard. So how did you achieve this community, and what can parents do who just don't have access to something like that and have to live in fear of, you know, the CPS phone call for letting their kids be kids?
No, it's definitely a question. And so that's why some of what I do in the book is kind of point towards parenting strategies and approaches. But a lot of it ultimately, I know, has to be cultural. We need to have a culture that accepts more free range parenting. So one thing is that parents can absolutely lead. The other kids in your neighborhood that are set to walk, free to walk around, that made it easier for you to say, okay, this is what I wanted. I wanted my kids to be able to walk around, and these other kids are setting this norm that does that. And in addition, so I used to live in Silver Spring, Maryland, where free range parents would get in trouble with the cops. But at our local playground, I actually had the opposite experience, where this one mother emailed me. She was like, so I keep meeting your kids at the playground. And I looked up, I found your email address on the neighborhood listserv, and I just wanted to reach out to you. Your kids are really nice, and I think it's great that you send them there unattended. She wanted me to like hold her hand to become more free range. So that's going to be part of it, is if it's just a cultural aspect, you can lead a community towards being more free range. But in Tim, some places, they had to pass actual laws in some places to make it legal. So Utah passed a free range parenting law, and that's what you might need in a place like Maryland.
But Tim, explain for our listeners, what's the connection between free range parenting and easier parenting? Because maybe that's not so obvious.
Yeah. So the story I tell in the book is at a family fish fry back when we lived, the St. Andrews was our parish in Silver Spring. And I was talking to the pastor, and he was saying, or the younger priest actually, and he was saying how a lot of the things a parish used to do have been replaced. And so feeding the poor is done by the county government, and the CYO sports get replaced by these intensive elite sports, especially Montgomery County, Maryland. And so he says, what should we be doing? What are the unmet needs of the people at this fish fry in this parish? And I said, to be honest, Father Bill, what we need is a place to bring our kids and ignore them while they run around. Yeah. And that's the Friday night t-ball, which is really just like an excuse for letting the families run around. But also, besides an actual outing, an actual neighborhood, when kids are free to roam the neighborhood, when there are sidewalks, when they don't get arrested by CPS for it, then the kids are healthier and happier, and the parents get to relax. So first, on the kids front, the Pediatrics Journal recently put out an op-ed saying that the rise in childhood anxiety is due to the fact that kids every minute is planned, that they don't get independent play free from the supervision of adults. Yeah. That makes their childhood less fun and makes them less able to come up with to deal with their own problems.
So, like they are lacking inner resources.
Yes. But what I say at the end of the preface is spending every minute supervising, planning, driving, and fretting, and spending every dime on training, enriching, and keeping kids busy isn't high quality parenting. It's just following the dumb rules of a family unfriendly culture. So, dear reader, please send the kids outside, grab a drink, and don't stop reading until someone comes back starving or bleeding. So what I'm trying to do is evoke
that line. It was so funny.
Evoke the experience that a lot of us had as kids of like getting kicked out and the door getting locked. And maybe we didn't like it at the time, but it definitely made us better.
Oh, we definitely never came home until it was getting dark in my neighborhood in Reston, Virginia. But all five of us, we would wander in the woods and play kickball in the neighborhoods, never came home until it started getting dark. So, Tim, in your book, you explore a lot of reasons for the baby bust. And one of the obvious reasons is that fewer people are getting married, or if they're getting married, they're getting married later. So, of course, marriage delayed means children delayed means fewer children, of course. But you go all the way back, and you mentioned this when you were giving us the overview of the book, the dating market, the dating culture, and appified dating, and just how weird and distorted the dating culture has become, such that young men are even afraid to ask a young woman out. So share with us more what you talk about in the book on that point.
Theoretically, dating apps should have made dating easier, because they clear up the questions, you know, that all of us wrestled with when we were teens, college kids, young adults. It's like, I like him. Does he like me? Yada, yada. So you get the double secret consent by the swiping on the app. So you're only connecting with people where you mutually have expressed interest. One of the things I found is that having that kind of double secret consent has programmed people to the point where they think nobody's even allowed to sort of hit on me or ask me out unless I've given them permission to do it, which is the opposite, which would be totally illogical in an unappified dating market, because how are you supposed to find out if somebody likes you without talking to them, flirting with them, asking them out? But so now there are multiple polls that show lots of people think it's just inappropriate to ask somebody out, and that dating the friend of your friends, well, that's perilous, because then if it goes wrong, then it creates all sorts of problems. But of course, friends of friends is the best possible way to meet somebody, in my opinion. And then there's even this story of this guy, Simon, who played on a co-ed volleyball team. And he really liked this girl on his volleyball team. He was afraid to ask her out because he thought it would be inappropriate. It would somehow be abusing the volleyball team connection to ask out a girl. And I'm just thinking, the point of a co-ed volleyball team is for you to meet somebody of the opposite.
Exactly.
Absolutely. It's not the volleyball.
And not to mention that any sort of office romance now is completely verboten. And of course, that used to be a very natural place to get to know someone, meet them. You know, it's the stuff of sitcoms, but now it's completely verboten.
Yeah. And so that moving dating out of normal human interactions, out of circles of friendships, out of social life, into its own thing that's mediated through this app, that's actually led to less dating, less marriage, and later marriage. One of the questions I ask in the book is, how could we have a sex recession given the sexual revolution? And I say, well, I think that actually the sexual revolution has led to this case where dating is scarier for women, because it's just more assumed that, you know, first date casual sex is going to happen, and who knows how that's going to go. And second, it's more terrifying for men to ask a girl out, because there's, you know, 1 in 6 women said that that would be sexual harassment. And then it turns young people into more perfectionists, because there's this illusion of an infinite number of people out there. And so what we've gotten is not a world where everybody's free and happy and free of all the old fashioned rules, but where more people are afraid and alone.
Tim, do you find that this is Lee, by the way, people, especially like in Catholic young adult communities in cities like DC, are so worried about just like going out for coffee or ice cream or something completely innocuous, even if it's not going to be a total love connection and you're not automatically like by the second date discerning marriage and family? I mean, I feel like there's so many, you know, I think there are people who are sort of rebelling against this anti-marriage culture, but it's almost going a step too far where they're missing sort of just the joys of getting to know the opposite sex by, you know, like I said, like having an ice cream, a drink, a coffee, roaming through a bookstore, if there are bookstores left, you know, like that kind of thing. Like are they jumping ahead to like, okay, is this marriage? Is this marriage material? Are we going to, you know, do we want the same things? You know, where do you fall on the spectrum of Catholicity? What about that?
Well, I had this one experience. This is only obliquely answering your question, because I haven't interrogated, and now I will start interrogating all the young reporters at the Examiner and research assistants at AEI about this.
Awesome.
But I had this experience where I spoke at a Knights of Columbus chapter, and the one guy who was about 30 came up to me afterwards and he said, well, isn't the problem that women are all getting educated? I said, well, I wouldn't exactly put it. And he cuts me off and he says, because if I marry a girl and she has a master's degree, I then have to pay off all the debt that she incurred to do that. And that's just not appealing.
Wow.
And I just thought, wow. And I just said, I think you need to rethink what you want in a wife. And if you have to pay off her debt, man up and do it. Okay. And
yeah.
So, well, but it would be a worthless education. You think it would be a worthless education for somebody you want to be the mother of your child to have? Anyway, my point was that this was a guy who his rebellion against our current culture had led him into an almost misogynistic view. And it was a sort of Catholic version of what I see as this problem that, where Andrew Tate, who's this horrible online influencer, has this appeal to young men who just, what they hear from their public schools is, well, you really should be more like women. You need to be feminized. All masculinity is toxic, da, da, da. And so you see these two extremes. And I think that's absolutely deadly if men are being pulled, young men are being pulled towards the, you know, a violent sort of misogyny or as the only option to being feminized. And that's one of the reasons I try to lay out a positive vision, which is be, to use some internet terms, a wife guy and a proud dad of your large adult sons. These are ways that people make fun of people like me on Twitter for, you know, gushing over our wife or bragging about our kids online is to say, oh, well, you know, these guys are just showing off. No, we should have more guys who base their identity on being dads the more of that that's out there, the more dadliness, as I put it, the more then that will be an actual positive role model. That's neither you should be more like women or you should adopt this sort of misogynistic view.
Yeah, Carter has actually, my husband has actually been trolled online for referring to me as his bride, which I don't, why do people even care? But they were really upset. They're like, a bride is a one-time thing and you're done. But, you know, it's
now I'm going to use that every time that I post.
Every time. Yes, that's what he does too. He makes up occasions to use it now.
Tim, why should people care in general that there is a baby bust, that there's a demographic cratering going on? Because I find that a lot of people are not paying attention. And when you point it out to them, they don't get the point. What's the point?
Well, and when you're a man like me, like they're saying, what is this, some Handmaid's Tale stuff? What, this is kind of creepy. I've repeatedly gotten that, like, this is creepy that you're caring about women's issues. Now, first of all, having kids is not just a woman's issue. It takes two to tango, and dads should be involved in raising their kids. But second of all, there's tons of reasons. So the economic one is kind of the easiest one. We already have fewer children in America than we did 10 years ago. The working age population is flatlining. And so in 20 years, we could have a shrinking population of people who could possibly be working. And so that will just further the spiral. And that's what's happening in Japan and South Korea right now. And so what that means is there's fewer people to do productive work while there are more retirees than ever. So all your retirement savings are worth nothing if there's nobody who answers a call when you know when your pipe springs a leak and you need a plumber. But that's the economic reason. And to me, that's almost the least interesting reason. More importantly, babies and children make the world happier. And it was kind of funny. I found myself digging through all these papers, sort of establishing how people are more hopeful when children are around, in the short term, in the medium term, in the long term, how happier people are more likely to have kids younger. And I realized I was looking for social science to prove that babies make us happy, which is actually an obvious thing to anybody who's experienced life like that. But more importantly, I think the baby bust reflects a real cultural sickness. I think it reflects something deeper that's wrong with us. And in the last chapter of the book, I call it civilizational sadness, a belief that we're actually not good. In the second to last chapter, I talk about a culture of sterility, a real desire to eliminate risk from your life, which then leads to this total isolation of saying, well, other people is risk. Commitment is risk. Relationships are risk. I'm going to play it safe and just have transactions, just have one-offs, just sort of live my life in the marketplace instead of in a thriving, life-filled environment. And so those are the two cultural maladies that I think underlie our baby bust.
And replacing children with things like dogs, right?
That, so I'm the most pro-dog guy who's ever written a book about the baby bust. I love dogs. But yes, you're exactly right. There is this idea that the word fur baby, though, still drives me crazy. People describe their dogs as fur. I was like, so are my babies just flesh baby? What are we supposed to call them?
Skin babies.
And when you take your dog to the vet, they're like, your little girl is great. She's here. And they're like, no, that's not my daughter. Not my girl. It's very annoying. And you know, there's AI. AI is going to, I'm sure, is going to be wanting to replace children with people, you know, fake little ones that interact with you. That's sort of scary.
Absolutely. And one guy said to me, one bartender, when I told him what I was writing on, he said, oh, none of my friends want a girlfriend because they say they can get from their phone anything they could get from a girlfriend.
Wow.
Oh, wow, yucky.
Well, but the phone won't nag you, and the nagging is what, you know, makes you straighten up and fly right.
Yeah, nagging works.
I did not sign up for this right now.
Tim, you talk about one of my favorite topics, which is another reason I think we have a baby bust, which is the way we've made motherhood and pregnancy so miserable and so controlled. And I laughed when you reminded me of the pregnancy rules, because I've long since stopped paying attention to them. But you reminded me of when I was pregnant with my second, how in one meal I managed to break three of them by having wine, raw cheese, and tartar. And I thought, they're going to do a citizen's arrest on me. But But the truth, and then you pointed to an interesting statistic that I hadn't read before, which is, you know, not only do we bury women, pregnant women alive with this litany of really nonsensical rules, but then we've made motherhood, the expectations and burdens of motherhood greater. And you point out the fact that women today, even though men are stepping up more than ever, that women are still, despite working outside the home more than ever, spending more time mothering. And so talk to us about that and how, you know, that further sort of deters people from being parents.
Yeah, so this absolutely becomes this slog. And I was just actually thinking about the fact that a lot of people who say, oh, I can never have kids, it's way too difficult. One of the things is they've somehow absorbed all of the, while you're pregnant, you can't eat cold cuts, don't touch dirt because a cat might have walked there, etc. All that stuff. Never touch, never have a single drink. And so they've absorbed that. But then they've also absorbed the idea of intensive parenting. And so the stat was that men since 1975 have doubled. So what they do is they measure how much of your week are you just doing parental duties. So this would be helping your kids with a homework, getting them dressed. I imagine that a lot of it is in the winter, the 10 hours it takes to put on snow boots on a three-year-old. And so it's, men have doubled the amount of time that they spend doing just parenting. And women, of course, since 1975, have been working outside of the home a lot more. Yet today's mothers spend 50% more time on just parenting tasks every week than their grandmothers did in 1975. And so that reflects this, again, this idea that parenting becomes this horrible, all-consuming thing. And I just thought of it again today because as we're talking, new reports are coming about the school closures during COVID and that kind of thing. And the same attacks on people like me who objected to the school staying closed is, oh, I'm sorry that you have to spend time with your kids. Oh, you're admitting that you spending time with your kids is harming them. And it has to be from childless people, I assume, who make those obnoxious comments, because what they're imagining parenting is 172 hours a week of just you helicoptering and tying the shoes of this little one. They're not imagining that you're hanging out with other adults in a backyard barbecue with all the kids running around. They're not imagining that you're letting the kids run free. And so there is this myth out of, I assume, of people who don't have kids that you're supposed to do 24/7 parenting.
Okay, Tim, this is Maureen again. So what works? What are some of the solutions to encourage people to have more babies? And it seems like in the book you talk about sort of the cultural solutions, which maybe you could summarize by saying, lighten up, it, you know, enjoy kids, realize that they're, you know, that babies bring happiness. But then there are the policy solutions. So you have a very interesting discussion about feminist solutions, workism. There's a really interesting section of the book on that. And you talk about when you subsidize a thing, you get more of that thing. So there's the idea of essentially paying people to have kids. And I found your example of what they do in France to be super interesting. And you say that's effective. So I'd love to hear more about that. But then you also say that the indirect subsidies don't seem to work. If you're subsidizing daycare, you're really subsidizing more work and playing into the whole idea of workism. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, so Europe started confronting its baby bust long before we did. I feel like it's just in the last 2 years that you've had, and the New York Times has actually led the way on this, and their readers get really angry at the suggestion that we shouldn't be depopulating the planet. But Europe has been wrestling with their falling birth rates for about a decade or more, and a lot of the countries put into place all sorts of, because they're more, you know, democratic socialist, all sorts of big government programs that are supposed to support family. What a lot of the Nordic countries did, what I call, they attempted fecund feminism or feminist fecundity. Fecundity, of course, meaning, you know, they making bigger families, having more kids. And so they thought that a generous paid leave and lots of subsidies for daycare would make the difference. And in the very short term, it did lead to a little uptick in babies. But then in the long run, it seems to have led to a decreasing birth rate in those countries and an increase in how people there rate the importance of work versus family. So a subsidy of daycare, there's a reason. I mean, this is, it's like a gift to the Chamber of Commerce. It's telling people, okay, don't worry about your kids. The market's taking care of your kids. You just worry about your job. So that is the worst possible thing if you're trying to help people build bigger families, is to subsidize daycare. What France does, and France has the highest birth rate in all of Europe, and it's not just because of immigration. They're native born, have 1.8 babies, while Europe is 1.5, the US is 1.6, 1.7. And so they throw a ton of money at parents. You get money, a baby bonus, a check when your baby's born. You have a monthly allowance. They also pay what they call paid leave, or, you know, maternity, paternity leave. But it ends up being basically a stay-at-home mom benefit for up to the first 3 years before the subsidized preschool kicks in. And so they actually have had success, and they, what shows is that a vast majority of mothers, when they have the option to, they stay at home rather than go back into the workplace, even though they would have free daycare at ages 1 and 2. But the problem is they spend a huge, huge amount of their GDP on this. And again, they tick themselves up from 1.5 to 1.8. And wow. So massive spending can work if it's directly to the parents, but it's super expensive. And if it doesn't change the culture, it's only going to do so much.
Well, Tim, I think books like yours are what can actually change the culture by making people understand the root of where this terrible idea that children are just burdens and they're too difficult to have is coming from, right? So thank you for joining us. And the book is Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be, by Tim Carney. And thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie, and we're delighted to have with us a focus missionary, Anthony Cirillo. He's at the University of Cincinnati, working with some wonderful Catholic students there. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thanks for having me, Doctor.
Maybe a lot of our listeners know what focus is, but maybe some don't. So can you explain to us what focus is?
Yeah, absolutely. So focus stands for the Fellowship of Catholic University Students, and I'm a full-time Catholic missionary to college students, and I serve on one campus at the University of Cincinnati, and we actually serve over 160 campuses around the U.S. and a few in Europe. So,
wow, 160.
Yeah, a little bit more than that.
Now, you say you're a mission. Do you wear a robe, or do you look like everyone else?
Yeah, I just wear rags everywhere. No, I look very much like everybody else. I'm actually married. I have 3 children. I'm 28 years old. I'm just a lay person, fully on mission to these students. I'm a little bit older for our missionaries at this point, because I've been doing this for 7 years, but it's been a huge blessing and been an amazing way that the Lord's used me and worked in my life as well.
So this is a tremendous commitment for a young married man with 3 children.
It sure is. Yeah, but we eased our way in. I started off not married and got married my time as a missionary, and we've started our family on mission, and it's not what I would have sketched out, but boy, the Lord has provided, and he's really used our vocation as well and leveraged that in the mission, you know, on campus. So better than I could have ever imagined.
Wow. You know, your life, that the way that you're living it must be such a testament to the students that you evangelize.
I certainly hope so. My wife hopes so as well. It's a joy, you know, to be able to bring in college students into our home. They get to see me. You know, the bread and butter things that we do are we mentor students, we lead Bible studies, we meet students where they're at on campus. When I have Bible study, you know, it's so often over at my home in my living room. Usually, you know, one of them for the past couple of years is right after I put my kids to bed. You know, I kind of roll out of putting my kids to bed and come downstairs, and usually there's a group of guys there on a Thursday night ready to read the Bible and pray together.
What kind of hunger do you feel on campus amongst young people for God?
I think there's a hunger for something true, mm-hmm. for something that matters. I think everyone has that hunger for God in some way, mm-hmm. but we try to fill it in many other ways, especially, you know, the college campus. You know, there's just the, you know, many different stereotypes, you know, things that we try to fill that God-sized hole with. You know, we're hungry for that living water that Jesus talks about in John chapter 4, but a lot of the students, you know, might be filling it with something else, whether that's, you know, alcohol, drugs, sex, or even just like an addiction to success. But it is, I think it is all pointing to wanting something more, wanting something that's going to persist forever, that's going to matter. Desire for intimate relationships. And you see, yeah, how that the desire for intimacy can get skewed, can be, draw people to things that are not good or kind of twisted.
What about a desire for things that are wholesome and pure in a world that doesn't give us, doesn't reflect that back to us?
I think that is a desire deep down. What I've found on campus with many people, we'll talk about, say, relationships, because when you use those words, I think about like dating relationships, for instance. And I think there is the desire for young people to have this, yeah, that this wholesome, pure, true love. In pursuit of that, they might be settling for less, mm-hmm. whether that's, you know, hookup culture, or that's settling for, you know, that boyfriend or girlfriend that they just think, oh, yeah, maybe they'll just change, or I can change them. And you know, they make all these different concessions. But I think deep down there is that a desire for something good, true, beautiful, which, you know, comes from our Creator, from God. And I think, you know, for my vocation, serving as a married missionary, not that we are by no means a perfect family, no means, but to show the students a little bit of our vocation, whether it's inviting them over for dinner or later tonight, I have people over to pray the rosary. We just do like a rosary and kind of like a meditation on Tuesday nights now. They get to, you know, come into our messy house, which we try to clean up, but you know, if three small children, we don't get everything picked up, we invite them into that. And you know, my wife will pray the rosary with us, and so they can kind of see, wow, these are, you know, some 28-year-olds who have kids and are praying the rosary with, you know, college students and sharing, you know, life with college students. So we can kind of show them, I think, sometimes like it is possible to, yeah, be in a faithful marriage with children that can be stressful. It can be hard, but it's really, really beautiful. So
that's a great testament, a great witness that you give to young people, to invite them into your home and see a young marriage and a young united marriage, a marriage united around God. And when so many young people, as we know, come from broken homes, they've never had that model to aspire to.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we've just seen it. And even just other missionaries, you know, I had a teammate a couple of years ago, and she became my teammate right after we got married. And I remember she asked my wife at a dinner early in the year, you know, we'd been married only a few months. She's like, how are you guys married? And I remember hearing this and I was like, ouch, like, I know I married up. I know, but like, ooh, that really stung. And what actually the backstory to that was she had come from a tough home environment, you know, where there was the marriage ended, you know, there was a divorce. And so she wasn't asking how did this guy, you know, get married to this gorgeous, amazing woman so much as it was, how are you actually living this vocation? I don't think this is possible. And I do remember, thanks be to God, you know, 2 years later, and this is a teammate who, you know, we spent a lot of time with together. She was there when our oldest was born, you know, just in the hospital back in those pre-COVID days where you could have a bunch of people visit you in the hospital. But I remember my teammate, you know, at the end of her time, and we were a team together for 2 years, she remarked that, you know, now she saw that vocation is possible, and the vocation of marriage is possible and attractive. And now I think she hasn't got married yet, but she's engaged. And it's just like, wow, like we got to play a little bit of a role there that the Lord used us. We didn't, you know, we didn't sketch it out like, oh, we're going to make sure we invest in her and she'll have this, you know, conversion or something necessarily, but we're just going to love her and, you know, invite her into our home life. And then the Lord did the heavy lifting. So it was awesome.
I remember being a college student and I remember being very lonely sometimes. And my own children who've gone to college or are in college now talk about their loneliness. How big a factor do you think loneliness is in college students' lives?
I think it's huge. I mean, especially even before COVID, you know, even before this, the social isolation, I think there's like something in the air that they're breathing. That's like, if I don't live a certain way, if I'm not going out with everybody, if I'm in my room alone on a Friday night, that is the worst thing ever. And I think there's kind of can be this illusion that in order to have friends in college, you have to partake in certain activities, we'll say, like whether it's drugs, alcohol, going out, you know. And I think like a joy in part of my job is showing the student like, hey, is connecting people. I love connecting people. It's showing that student who says, man, I don't got anything to do Friday night. Like, I guess I have no other choice but to either sit in my room and twiddle my thumbs or go hit the bars with my fake ID. And say, actually, you know what? We actually are trying to create something different over here that's attractive and that doesn't just have drug, sex, and alcohol, you know? Mm-hmm. That's been another just joy where it's like you can live fully alive without these substances. And yeah, for like students who are of age, let's talk about, you know, how we can have a drink and not get drunk, and what does sobriety actually mean, or what does chastity actually mean? Like, we can really lean into those conversations. But yeah, totally, the college campus, it can be this place where, yeah, everybody is, I'm surrounded by people, but I feel so alone. And there can be many different reasons to that.
Many college campuses have Catholic mm-hmm. student centers, Newman centers.
Yep.
Do you work with them, or is this a completely separate thing, or do you inhabit separate areas of the sort of that yeah. campus Catholic life?
That's a great question. The way that we work with Focus is we always want to partner with that campus ministry on the ground. We don't want to create a separate mm-hmm. thing. We want to add and like supplement what they have going on and just make it better. We want to like broaden their reach, hopefully. You know, we aren't going to create events that are like going to rival the Newman Center's events, but we also want to bring people to the Newman Center. We want to bring them to Mass. And maybe we also want to like make some of those events better sometimes. Maybe there's like a suggestion a missionary can make, hey, like if we thought about doing this, maybe this could help us reach more people on campus. So we very much want to come in and respect and honor what's been going on at the Newman Center, and then say, how can we help? How can we add here? Never want to become like a competitor.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Anthony Cirillo. He's a Focus missionary at the University of Cincinnati. Anthony, recently over 175 students from the Archdiocese of Cincinnati attended Seek 21. I know that Father Mike Schmidt, who was a guest with us recently, mm-hmm. gave an amazing message. How did it go over this year with the pandemic and the change? I know that the format had to change significantly.
Yeah, I mean, so Seek 21, you know, if we rewind pre-COVID, Seek 21 was going to be in St. Louis, and we were hoping to have, you know, gosh, probably close to 30,000 people together over the new year, you know, reining in 2021, but obviously COVID changed that. Yeah, thanks be to God, like you said, we actually have three campuses with Focus in the Archdiocese here, and through some planning and some creative planning and collaboration with the Archdiocese, we were able to kind of do a remote Seek 21, where Seek 21 this year was around, anyone could go around the globe because it was virtual, but we said we want to create that conference experience to the as best we can in the safest way we can. We want to create that in Cincinnati for our students, and by the grace of God, we had, yeah, it's like 175 students from Cincinnati coming together for Mass to watch different keynotes, you know, to stream them. For us, you know, the particular, our campus at the University of Cincinnati, we actually had an opening night at a local brewery, like a Catholic-owned brewery down the street. We just partnered with them. We're like, can we stream this and then have all our people come here? They're named Humble Monk Brewery. So if you're in Cincinnati, check out Humble Monk. Really, really good. So yeah, we made the best of it. And it was a lot to pull together, but it was extremely enjoyable. And students who would not have maybe traveled with us to St. Louis to go to like a normal Seek in the past years, they were like, well, I can stay in Cincinnati. I can pay to go to this. And then I'm going to go to this brewery one night for the keynotes. You know, we're watching Sister Miriam and Bishop Barron. Is, you know, they're being streamed up on the wall of this brewery, and we are hanging out having pizza, and you know, people who are of age are having beers.
How much fun.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah. Like we're just grateful that, you know, we had so much support from our local supporters and from the bishop and from our chaplains to pull something off that was really special. One of the other highlights of it is we had an adoration night. So usually at these Seek conferences, they're usually every year, and they're usually in, you know, one location, and then everyone from around the country gathers together, and you'll have these masses with 10,000 college students or 20,000 college students at Mass together in one spot. And we'll also have these adoration nights where it's, you know, adoration and then confession being offered. And usually, you know, you're in a huge, you know, conference center, and thousands of people are in adoration together in front of our Lord. We couldn't quite do that, but we actually had it downtown here at the cathedral. We were able to rally, you know, local priests and say, hey, we got, you know, hopefully 200 students coming in. We'd love for everyone to be able to go to confession that night. So we, with our chaplains, we rallied, you know, like 15 priests, and then, you know, all these students could go to confession. And some of them went for the first time. Some of them went to adoration for the first time. And
nice. What
a gift, you know, these sacraments are in our faith. And it's, you know, I get to introduce students to these sacraments. I get to help them, you know, find the Lord in these ways. It's a joy.
People who at that age go to college, they're like sponges. They're at the age yeah. where you are ready ready to change and grow and become. How wonderful that they have people like you helping them to grow and change and become more like Christ.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's all that we want.
These days of cancel culture and ideological division and political division, mm-hmm. have you felt that the things got a little dicey on the ground at the University of Cincinnati, or do you always feel that you're operating in a welcoming space?
That's a great question. I think with COVID, some of those like places where we would face outright like opposition at a public university, just like students aren't really there right now. So whether that's like here we have online classes and, you know, a lot of people aren't just walking around outside, even though it's a gorgeous day, it's just not as much like foot traffic on campus. And that would be where we sometimes would run into those, you know, more like aggressive, like atheists or things like that. I'd say here, you know, students overall are really open to talking, really open to conversation. A lot of people were raised Catholic, so I think that's a great opportunity. You know, we talk about like the new evangelization. It's really that re-evangelization of areas that had been evangelized when John Paul talks about that. So yeah, I say people are really open. Yeah, we haven't actually faced like a ton of like aggressive opposition. However, there is like a lot of just people just don't care. You know, it's just, oh yeah, whatever. Like, you know, I'll do that later. You know, I think relativism, you know, is still just so rampant. It's like, oh, that's great. That's your truth.
Yeah.
You know, this is my truth. And you know, if sometimes just people don't even want to really talk about that. It's just a kind of a lazy, like, yep, yeah, you got your opinion, I got mine, leave me alone, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
so
I mean, sometimes
that.
I wish we had more of the people that are like, hey, I'm going to plant my feet in the ground and I'm going to push against you. I'm going to say, hey, you're absolutely wrong. And I'd rather have that discussion than the like whatever, you believe that, I believe this.
Oh, you know? I agree, right? Because it's in the discussion and the dialogue that you can open minds.
Yeah, exactly.
So. And hearts, of course.
yeah. The Lord, you just let the Lord come into that, and just through friendship and charity, you know, hopefully that's a powerful witness. And then, yeah, if you have that opportunity to like logically try to walk through a few things with people, that's great. But usually it takes a while. It's not one conversation, as I'm sure you know.
Anthony, if people who are listening who maybe have a kid in college, how do they find out more about Focus? How can they point people towards you? And also, mm-hmm. before we get off, I want to hear about how you're funded and how we can help you.
Oh, sure. Yeah, thanks. So I'd say if you want to learn more about Focus, I would just go to, you know, www.focus.org, FOCUS.org. And you can, learn a lot about the campuses we serve. There's a tab that says find a campus, and you can just basically search by state for a campus that we serve at. If you are searching and you don't see that campus that maybe your child or grandchild's going to, there's another resource called the Digital Campus, which is like, we have missionaries in Denver and across the country that will invest in students digitally and just reach out to them and mentor them from a distance.
Oh, that's great.
It's amazing. I mean, there's been so many opportunities to just try to innovate. And I think COVID too has just pushed the envelope on innovating, especially in that digital space.
Very true.
And I'd say too, like if you also see a campus, you don't see a campus on there, start praying that, you know, we get to that campus. Or, you know, if you have a connection to the campus or a connection somewhere, like ask the question, hey, like I heard about this thing Focus, like why doesn't, you know, this university have it? Like maybe knock on a door and ask the question. Yeah, that's how I'm here at Cincinnati. It's a whole other story. So,
and how can people donate to this great cause? Because I'm assuming this is kept alive on donations and people being generous all across the country.
100%. I mean, I would say I don't just like, I thrive on support. We not only survive, we want to thrive on the support. And that's really what that looks like for every missionary, as a team of dozens of individuals and families who are praying for that missionary and financially giving to support the whole budget of that missionary, the salary, and then all the stuff that they need to buy on campus, or mm-hmm. everything. It's everything. So the way that you can support a missionary is you could also just go to, again, like focus.org, and then you could just say, find a missionary. And then if you know a missionary, or you could look up me, for instance, just Anthony Cirillo, Cirillo, and we have all of our support pages, and you can make like a special gift or like a monthly gift to fuel our mission. If you even have a campus near you, say, you know, you have that a child or grandchild that's going to campus, you know, nearby, and you want to support that team, you can look up that campus. And there's even a way to give to a particular like team through our website, focus.org. So that's pray for us, and then like give, and then spread the word, because so many people don't know that we're on 160 campuses. They don't know that we have over 800 missionaries serving on those campuses, that it's really in some areas of the country, Focus is one of the best kept secrets of the church. I'm a little biased, you know, being a on-campus missionary, but
Anthony, I'm 100% sure that you're doing tremendous work and exactly where you need to be, which is with the youth, the future of our country, the future of our faith. How wonderful that people like you are available for them. And I urge my listeners, go to focus.org and donate. Find Anthony Cirillo or one of his brother missionaries or sister missionaries. You have women too, right?
Yes, men and women. Yep. Each team is about two men and two women usually.
Oh, well, wonderful. So please go to focus.org and help these wonderful young people out. Thank you, Anthony, for joining us.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
And now Father Roger Landry offers us, as is customary, a short and inspiring homily to prepare us for this Sunday's gospel.
This is Father Roger Landry, and it's a privilege for me to be with you as we enter into the consequential conversation the risen Lord Jesus wants to have with each of us this Sunday. Last Sunday, as you remember, we concluded the first National Eucharistic Congress in 83 years and the first National Eucharistic Pilgrimage in the history of the Church. This Sunday at Mass, we begin, almost on divine cue, a multi-week journey as Jesus seeks to lead us more deeply into the mystery of his life-giving love in the Holy Eucharist that the pilgrimage, the Congress, and the whole Eucharistic revival are trying to catalyze. The Church has been focusing at Sunday Mass this year, as we do every third year, on the Gospel of St. Mark. If we continue chapter by chapter in this progression, we would have tackled this week St. Mark's version of the miracle of the multiplication of the loaves, the only miracle of Jesus recounted in all four Gospels. But the Church substitutes for us here St. John's account of the same miracle, because St. John shows how Jesus used it as the launching pad for a long homily on the Eucharist, which will occupy our thoughts over the next 5 weeks. The miracle of the multiplication of the loaves and fish was a true miracle, something that happened in Capernaum during the time of the Passover, 1 year before the Last Supper. But Jesus used this miracle as a sign of what he was intending to do for us in the Eucharist. Over the next several weeks, we will therefore, providentially, deepen our understanding of Jesus' self-gift in the Holy Eucharist. Today, we'll focus on the miracle of the multiplication of the loaves and fish itself. This miracle of the loaves and fish teaches us very clearly about how God generally works and what he expects of us. When Jesus saw the famished crowds, he could have easily worked a miracle from scratch. He who created the heavens and earth out of nothing, who fed the Israelites in the desert with miraculous manna and quails from heaven, could have easily satiated the hungry crowd ex nihilo, from nothing. He didn't need human or material assistance. But that isn't the way he acted. He first asked his disciples what their resources were. Were we to buy bread for all these people to eat? Philip replied that not even 6 months' wages, say $25,000 by today's standards, would have been enough to feed the crowd of about 5,000 people. The only one who had anything was a young boy who had 5 loaves and 2 fish, food that wouldn't be enough to feed a typical family, not to mention a strapping young adolescent. The Lord started with the young boy's generosity. Even though, strictly speaking, he didn't need anything to work a miracle, he wanted to involve the boy, the apostles, and the crowd. He wanted to start with what the people had and bring it to completion. This is the way God generally operates with us. He could choose to do everything himself, but he knows that that wouldn't be ultimately good for us. He could, just like a parent often gives a child a project and helps the child complete it, so God, out of love, wants to give us the joy and dignity of being cooperators with him in what he's doing for us and for others. Look at the wonderful story of the apostles. Jesus wanted to involve these simple men in the most important mission ever, the proclamation of the kingdom of God and the salvation of the human race. Rather than ascending into heaven, he could have chosen to stay here on earth until the end of time, traversed every land, preached in every town and village, healing, exercising, forgiving, and establishing the church. But he wanted these men to share in his mission. He gave them his message and his authority. They weren't necessarily talented men in worldly eyes. They weren't those who had humanly meager starting materials. They were sinners just like us. But those capable of saying yes to God, offering to him their goodwill and their talents, and allowing the Lord to multiply their offerings by his divine power. God wants the same from us. Regardless of how many gifts and blessings the Lord has given us, he wants us to give them back to him so that he can do far greater things with them. We might have received only a minimal education in the faith through religious instruction, but the Lord can use this to make us a great apostle like he did with St. Peter. We might not be very gifted as a teacher, but with the Lord, we might be the best of teachers to our children about what's most important of all. We might not have had much in the way of material possessions, but then we offer them to the Lord, and he might use them to save others' lives in this world or the next. We might be advanced in years or ill and think that we don't have much still to give, but offered to the Lord, what we bestow can be incredibly fruitful. This lesson has a very concrete application what the church is celebrating this Sunday for the fourth time, the World Day of Grandparents and the Elderly, which Pope Francis instituted to be celebrated every year on the fourth Sunday of July, a day chosen transparently to connect it as closely as possible to the July 26th feast of Saints Joachim and Ian, the parents of Mary and grandparents of Jesus. In his message in anticipation of the inaugural celebration, Pope Francis asked grandparents and fellow seniors, "What is our vocation today at our age? It is to preserve our roots, to pass on the faith to the young, and to care for the little ones." While grandparents and seniors may not be as physically vigorous as they once were, they still have, he implied, 5 loaves and 2 fish to offer to God for the spiritual feeding of multitudes. And he was not only summoning seniors to this work, but leading the whole world in appreciation for what grandparents and seniors still have to give and do give. Just like the Lord never, ever goes into retirement, he stated, there's no retirement age from the work of proclaiming the gospel and handing down traditions to your grandchildren. Since he was elected the successor of St. Peter at age 76, he hasn't slowed down in trying to live and teach the faith. Citing the biblical figures of Abraham, Moses, Tobit, Eleazar, Elizabeth, Zechariah, Simeon, Anna, and Nicodemus, all of whose major contributions to salvation history took place when they were advanced in years, he urged grandparents and seniors to see themselves as still very important laborers in the Lord's vineyard, beginning with the very precious resource of their prayer and the example of love for the Lord and the gift of time, which they can richly spend with their grandchildren, teaching them, praying with them, playing with them, giving them encouragement and unconditional love, listening to their stories, attending their games, concerts, and academic milestones, and in so doing, helping their children and in-laws to grow in their maturation as parents. The world is so much better because of the way so many grandparents and seniors live out their vocation. And this fourth World Day of Grandparents is an opportunity to celebrate them, thank them, commit to spend time with them, recommit to the covenant of love with them, and pray for them. It's also a day for them to focus on passing on to subsequent generations the legacy of their Eucharistic faith and love. The Holy Eucharist is the reality to which the miracle of the multiplication of the loaves and fish points. In the Eucharist, Jesus again takes bread, blesses it, breaks it, and gives it once more in a multiplication that's even more miraculous, stretching across the centuries in every land, from the upper room to the altar of our parish church. This is a sacrifice that has fed billions of God's children and prepared them for the heavenly banquet. And in the very way Jesus established it, he showed how he wanted to involve us intimately. We use not grain and grapes, but bread and wine, the work of human hands, because God intended from the beginning our own contribution in this one great sacrifice to the Father. When the priest prays during the beautiful dialogue at the beginning of the liturgy of the Eucharist, "Pray, brothers and sisters, that this sacrifice, yours and mine, may be acceptable to God, the Almighty Father," we focus on the reality that the Eucharist is not just the offering of Christ, but together with him, the offering of his whole mystical body, the Church. And there's one other detail from the miracle we shouldn't miss, because it likewise applies to the celebration of the Eucharist. Clearly, Jesus could have worked the miracle without leaving leftovers, but he did so to overflowing, leaving 12 wicker baskets full of extra food. We could say he was intentionally leaving one for each apostle, to remind each of them and us, in a sense, of what we're supposed to do with the Eucharistic food we received, to live off it and share that food with others. Rather than keeping the miracle of the multiplication to ourselves, Jesus wants us to share it, filling our baskets to overflowing, so that we might lavishly share his gifts with others, offering our bodies, our blood, our calluses, our sweat, our tears, our joys, however many loaves and fish we have, out of similar love for God and others. So we prepare to share in this great and ongoing miracle this Sunday. Let us ask Jesus to give us the courage and the generosity to offer our whole life to him in his service, so that he, in feeding us, may be able to use us and what he's given us to feed others. This is what the missionary phase of the National Eucharistic Revival, begun just last Sunday, is all about. God bless you.
Thank you, Father Landry. To hear more from Father Landry, check out his website at catholicpreaching.com and You can also catch his writings at EWTN's own National Catholic Register. A big thank you to all our listeners for joining us. I hope that this show was helpful. I hope that it gave you more peace and more hope and more joy, and you go with our prayers.